financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Do you find that's the case with credit, that sometimes you see people who are totally credit worthy, but their score is lousy, or the other way around, their score is great because they pay everything, but they're doing it by leveraging their credit cards?
Yeah, I think the scoring thing is very funny to me. The example I always give is like you and I might have the same exact credit score, 700, let's just say, or 720. You know, so it's good, but it's not great. Except a couple months ago, you were 650 and you're on your way up, and a couple months ago, I was 820 and I'm on my way down. But a number's a number, and we both have the same credit score, and we're treated the same. And I think that's where we run into a little bit of the problem when we start to narrow things down to a single number, right?
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How are you this morning?
I am good, and we are joined by some guests.
We are joined by one guest anyway, Michael Tarquinio from Best Egg, a company that some of you may know as a lender and others as a financial service company, but I'll let him describe it. What we're really discussing today is, you know, if you are somebody who thought companies don't care about you, right, you're just a number. Michael and I got into a discussion about this, about the evolving relationship between companies and you. So treating the customer in a way that builds a relationship. And I just want to turn this over to Michael and say welcome. And please give us a little history about Best Egg.
So I'm Mike Tarquinio. I'm the Senior Director of Customer Experience and Insights at Best Egg. Best Egg is a financial services company. Our core focus is on loan products. And our target market is limited savings customers. And when people talk about, you know, personal loans, they have this interpretation or this idea in their head that our customers are on the poorer side of the financial spectrum and that they have bad credits. And the fact is, through our research, we know that our actual customers are across the entire spectrum. So we have customers that do sit on the lower end of a credit spectrum, but we also have customers that have 750 credit scores who are making six figures. And they leverage our products as part of their broader plan for how they manage their money. So all year long, they're doing their thing, and they may take out a personal loan to go on a vacation. And then they pay that off over the next year or two, and then take out another personal loan to do some construction on their home. So people have this misunderstanding of what a personal loan is and how they might leverage it. But we kind of sit in there to help support people who are looking for some financing for an event or an emergency.
So you see a lot of repeat borrowers. Is what you're telling me, right?
Some cases. So I break our customers into two groups. It's those who need financial assistance for an emergency. So car breaks down, there's a medical emergency, they've had a significant change in their income and need some kind of assistance. And then we have the planners who use personal loan as part of their ongoing plan to do things that they want to do.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because you led off with something that we often say too. There's a misunderstanding that the people that we deal with are, you know, bad at managing their money or have no money or in dire straits. And it just isn't true. Most of the clients that both your company and mine deal with are middle to middle upper income with a decent credit score. They're just hanging on to the edge of the cliff sometimes, right? Yeah. Best Egg has done a lot of research, it seems. Have you seen a shift in the last several months? And can you talk about that in the way that customers are engaging with your company?
Engagement is pretty steady. We see an uptick when the economy starts going through changes. Any changes, we'll start to see an uptick. So rates come down, we'll see an uptick as people look to refinance higher interest rates. If the economy is getting bad or people are losing jobs, we'll see an uptick as people take out loans to kind of rebalance where they are based on the changes that they're impacted. We do a quarterly macroeconomic tracker. So we reach out to our customers and we get sentiment, which is, again, another way to say, how do you feel about a lot of topics, specifically financially related topics. And so the last one we did was beginning of April, and it was the largest significant negative slide that we've seen over the last 3 years. So how do you feel about your finances? How do you feel about the economy? Are you stressed about being able to pay bills? Are you stressed about the cost of living? All of that has slid more negative than we've seen in doing this quarterly for the past 3 years.
Yeah. It's funny when we do this research, we think we're going to be surprised sometimes, but more often than not, it just confirms our worst fears or whatever. So I would say, what does that really mean to somebody? That kind of a shift. What does that mean to someone who's living paycheck to paycheck?
Problem is uncertainty, right? Living paycheck to paycheck when things you feel are okay or a little bit more positive, I think it allows you to feel more comfortable in where you're at, right? So you're still living paycheck to paycheck, but there's some optimism. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. There's even some potential, idea that you're going to get there. You're going to overcome the debt. You're going to finally get where you need to be. When we see all of these changes and people start having the negative sentiment, I think that's where people are impacted the most, right? So you're living paycheck to paycheck, but now you don't know if that paycheck's going to come in the next couple of weeks. You don't know if that cost of groceries is going to go up, is rent going to go up, or the cost of my basic living essentials going to go up. So now I'm getting further and further into debt. So I think it's that shift that impacts your day-to-day when you're living paycheck to paycheck.
I know that somebody out there will laugh at me when I say this, but this is a fun conversation.
Well,
Believe it
so
or
I'm
not.
a data person, and so when you can look at data that reaffirms some of the things you think or contradicts it, it's great because you have something that you could pull up and say, oh, well, look, I have proof. I have evidence that shows this. And I think that's what makes it interesting. It's not that it's interesting that things are right now negative or appear to be negative. It's that we have the data that shows this and we know the impacts. And from an organizational perspective, it allows us to react, right? So we
That's right.
see this negativity. We see the sentiment starting to turn down about the economy. So what we do is we look to drive people into areas of our business that offer support and help. So we have an element of our organization called Best Egg Financial Health. It's the area where we drive people for a lot of basic tools to help support them thinking through how they will manage their money or their debt, or to think about, like, what does it look like? What is debt to income currently, in my situation? How do I overcome that? So we can start to shift our messaging and put people in position to be able to learn a little bit more about, overcoming that fear they might have based on the current situation.
Yeah, it really is a pleasure to see a company, approaching this with such intentionality. And it does sound like our paths cross a lot. We should maybe chat after the show about how our paths might cross and what we can do to help people. But what I'm hearing from you in this sort of ongoing thread is that, transactional support isn't enough anymore. We're dealing with people's emotions. They want to have a relationship. We need to have a relationship with them if we're going to keep their business, right? So, if I'm right, if I'm in line with your thinking about that, what can a company like Best Egg do to ensure that that trust and relationship are front and center?
No, we're definitely aligned. What we're seeing trends over time and in recent time, the last year, is that when sentiment starts to go down, it doesn't change their need for the money. So we still see applications going up. But what we do is look to focus on how we build a positive relationship with them outside of the transaction. So we know they need the transaction, and we've got videos and stories of people telling us how valuable we were in stepping in to help them solve a very tough problem that they were incurring. But we want to focus now on how do we build a long-standing relationship, not only from a business perspective, because at the end of the day, if we could build that relationship, it lowers our delinquency, but also we can help them along their path to feel more confident about the decisions they're making about their money. So we're on a we have a goal for the next, I'd say, 18 months to 2 years to start looking at opportunities to develop stronger relationships with our customers. So being proactive, reaching out to them and inviting them to come back and learn about either some of our tools or reaching out to see if there's ways that we can offer help or support. We're examining ways to proactively look at potential stumbling blocks that sit in your path from a financial stability perspective related to making your payments. And like, can we be proactive and offer them payment assistance or ways to ensure that they stay positive about where we're going with the economy.
Absolutely. You know, I wanted to go back for a minute to something that you said a couple of moments ago about people being worried that if they're living paycheck to paycheck and they don't know if their job is going to be there, that that's an extra sort of catalyst, right? Or an extra load on them. Do you find that some people are wanting to borrow now, even if they don't need the money, because they're afraid they won't qualify for a loan in the not too distant future?
Great
Or
question. I don't have the
do they tell
details
you?
on that. Yeah, like that's a good, very good question. I don't know that we have the specific details on that. We do have opportunity for people to give us some narrative about why they're taking the loan. Nobody's been proactively like squirreling money away. I think the concern would be is that like you're gonna get interest and start making payments on something that you may not need. So I haven't seen that in the data yet, but it doesn't mean it's not there. Again, they're not going
Yeah.
to tell you that, most likely.
I can tell you, but I can only tell you from our cross section here that people will get a home equity line of credit and sock it away and say they won't take the money out. It's just a line of credit, but they'll qualify for it now because they're afraid they won't qualify later. And I have to warn them that it's not a given thing, that the bank can pull it at any time that they want to because their situation has changed and they don't want to have that credit out there. But I have seen a sense that people are worried. Like, what do I have to get in place now to survive? And of course, we talk a lot about building cash reserves, right? Let's build cash reserves. So you don't have to take a loan out for an emergency. Instead, you're taking the loans out, as you said, for something you want to do. And then, of course, we manage those loans with them so that they pay them off on time and early and all of that. But it's a very interesting position you're in, I would say, and especially to talk to somebody who's dealing with the data behind the scenes. You talked to me a little bit off camera about something called the Nest. Will you tell us about the Nest? That's a research-driven sort of environment, right?
So a couple of years ago, we founded a branded community called The Nest, where we proactively invite customers to come and join The Nest. The Nest is the community we leverage for research. So within the customer experience world, there's two main focuses. We have a whole broad voice of customer program that is reactive. So you've interacted with us in some way, and we will engage with you with surveys, digital intercepts, or the chat logs that are happening between our agents and you on our website. So that's our VOC program. It's reactive. We'll go into that data, we'll analyze it, and provide reports out to the organization. The Nest is really our insights group, right? So this is when various people throughout the company come to us and say, hey, we'd love to understand customer sentiment or customer decision or thoughts about something. So we'll go to our customers, and we could segment that group by a lot of different demographics, and we bring things, questions or surveys or even designs, and we ask them for their feedback on that. And that directly impacts what we end up building. And I'll tell you, one of the greatest things, and this is a little counterintuitive, one of the greatest things to pull out of that is hard no's. So you go in there and you have this idea that we're going to do this and it's going to work, and everybody's like, nope, that's a terrible idea. That saves us time and money. It's incredibly helpful as an organization to be able to get that kind of feedback. And when we get the yeses or we get the direction that we're on to something, that's incredibly helpful too. When we want to show our customers that we're listening to them, so when we get onto a scent and it's going in the right direction, we make sure that we, drive that through our business team and our product team to have that built. Now, very rarely does a test lead to build in a couple of weeks. Usually it takes a couple of months to get through that process. And then we build it and launch it. And then it shows our dedication to meeting our customers where they are, listening to them, and ensuring they have what they need to be a successful customer and future partner as we grow our relationship with them.
Well, I couldn't ask for anything more than that. We do need to go to a break, but when we come back, I want to talk to you more about repeat borrowers and all the things that you're seeing emotionally in the market if you'll stay with us.
All right, Francis, can I get your phone number?
Of course, it's 413-773-3333.
Or you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, next on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi.
Hi, and Michael Tarquinio from Best Egg is joining us. So we are deep into the data of how a company the size of Best Egg is being very intuitive and very proactive about trying to build relationships with customers, because I think we all know at this point, transactional support is not enough, right? We need to treat people like they're people. So I have a question for you, Michael. For repeat borrowers, do you think, because we talked about this earlier in the show, that people will take out one installment loan, then another, you know, and then another in sort of a rolling fashion. Do you think that that's more about cash flow, or is it about staying afloat, if you know?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think it really depends on your scenario. Like I said, our data has shown us that people on the upper end of the income scale and the credit score leverage this as kind of like a slush fund, right? So every couple of years they want to do a big vacation, they want to do, you know, buy something big. They'll leverage this as a slush fund. I would say that people on the lower end of the income scale and the credit score tend to need this. You see the repeat business coming back and forth because of the way that things are changing in their economic life. So jobs are changing, spouses are getting sick, children need dollars for educational purposes. Those are the kind of stories that we hear on that side, where the repeat business is to kind of stay ahead just a little bit. It's never to make a giant leap. These people aren't looking to come in and grab $15,000 or $20,000 to go on a vacation. These people are looking for a couple thousand dollars at a time over the course of every couple of years to pay off the car problem that they had, to pay off the medical bill that they incurred when something happened unexpected that wasn't covered or they didn't have insurance. So it really does sit in both of those worlds.
Can you tell me, was there some sort of, are you sensing sort of this mental exhaustion from people? I don't know how much you deal with people directly, but in terms of the company doing the research, is there a sense of this mental exhaustion about finance lately that maybe wasn't there, say, a year ago or so?
I think the economic tracker shows a little bit of that. We also do IDIs, which is our one-on-one interviews with our customers, and we'll do them for a variety of reasons. Sometimes to dig into a specific topic, but you don't just jump on an interview with somebody, as you know, and dive right into a topic. You get to know them a little bit.
Yes.
And I could say almost 90% of the time that we're having these conversations, the exhaustion comes through immediately. They're talking about their money. They're talking about their situation, heartbreaking stories. We had a woman who took out a personal loan. She had contemplated for months harvesting her eggs and selling them as a means to an end for money because she had all of these bills. And she turned to us and we were able to get her a loan, and she didn't have to, you know, have that invasive medical procedure. But talking about stress and exhaustion, thinking about that kind of decision, and people who've, you know, leveraged our financial options to pay for cancer treatments for a loved one. They don't want to be in this situation. They got stuck in a situation where they needed that money. And I think that's the draining part, is knowing that because of the time that they are in their economic life, they just couldn't make it happen any other way. And that burden is very exhausting to them.
Yeah, I mean, the stories are what really bring us to do what we do, right? It's the stories like that that cause you to get up in the morning and go and try and solve a problem in some way. I don't have any sort of lending institutions on the show very often. I have them from time to time when I think that they're sort of responsible, right? Being a lender does not mean you have nefarious means. It just means you're offering something that people need, and you get an interest rate in return. the thing we want to make sure of is that people borrow responsibly and they know how to pay back their loans responsibly. And as you know from our system, that speeds that process up and makes helps them build the other financial stability that they need. But that emotional temperature you're talking about sensing, I'm seeing across the board. There's still some optimism. People are still like, we're inherently optimistic, like it's going to be okay, we're going to get another job, or we're going to do this well. But initially, heads are hanging a lot these days. If you had a magic wand, if you could wave a magic wand, Michael, and fix one thing, one barrier that keeps customers from achieving their real financial peace of mind, what would it be, and what do you think it would take to actually get there?
This is an easy one for me. It's something I've thought about for years. It's a huge gap. You see tiny things, instances of this popping up, but I think there needs to be mandatory financial literacy learning starting at a very young age. Middle school through high school. Listen, I love education. It's obviously very important, but I think there's arguments to be made that there's elements of our current educational system that don't have relevance anymore. I'm an older person. I went through school. We had to take cursive writing. Nobody does cursive writing anymore. It's a lost art. And yes, it's beautiful, but like, was there value in teaching a whole bunch of kids with, under a threat of ruler to learn cursive writing? So today, I think there are fundamentals in every single person's life that are facts. You are going to probably need to buy a car. You're going to need to get insurance. You're going to need a savings account and some banking stuff. If you're looking forward thinking in children and 529s, these are nothing. None of these items are taught in school as part of a curriculum that prepares you. And I was watching this comedian recently, and he talks about, learning so many weeks on triangles, and now he's an adult and he never needs that information. But nobody taught him how to do this basic life skills you need from a financial perspective. And it's things that everybody needs to do. And the fact is, you can graduate high school, and whether you go to college or not, you're on your own to figure that out. Now, maybe you're lucky and your parents have some background and they can help and support with that, but a lot of us didn't have that growing up. And it's very much kind of like search and find and try to figure it out. The greatest thing that we have now for younger people is the internet. So you do get a lot of information available to you. But I think without a guided curriculum to get you there or to even give you the basics, you're really just kind of hoping that things work out. And that's no way that we should be running, especially around financial literacy.
Yeah, thank you.
Of
What he said,
course.
folks. What he said. There, the government puts out a financial literacy course for free to high schools, and I get called into the high school because it doesn't include anything about managing your debt. So I go to the high school, and and people say, or I'll ask, how long do you think it's going to take you to pay off your student loans? And some wise guy in the room always raises their hand and says, forever. They have no idea. And they're 17 years old, having an 18 years old take out these loans. No real idea of what that means. I t completely agree with you. At a young age, we need to start teaching people not just how to manage their money, but how not to be afraid of money.
Like I went through, so I graduated, high school in the early 90s, shuffled off to college, and every 5 minutes across college campuses, there's tables selling you credit, offering you credit cards.
And giving
And
you
it
a
was like,
t-shirt.
yeah, no problem. Who cared about credit? You just sign your name, you get a credit card, you buy in all this stuff that you don't need. And now it's shifted to a real fear of credit. A lot of young people have no idea what to do with credit. They're actually afraid of it, but it's something they need. So, we have to find a balance between not educating them and making them fearful. And somewhere in the middle, they have to understand the value of credit and how to be responsible with it.
Well, let me ask you a question about that because I find that a very interesting comment. Do you think, so let's just go back and give our followers just a tiny bit of history about credit, right? Fair Isaac credit or a FICO, that FICO score that you folks see. That's two guys, Fair and Isaac, who decided, hey, this is a good idea to take your credit history and stick a number on it so bankers can look at a number, right? But I'm old enough to remember the day when a bank would actually read your credit report. Okay, so now we go by a number. Do you think that, well, so let me say, I find people complain to me quite a bit that their number is this and they can't get a loan because of it, or their number is great and everybody's offering them money, but it doesn't really reflect what their actual financial picture is these days, because there's this sort of disconnect, just like you were talking about. Do you find that's the case with credit, that sometimes you see people who are totally credit worthy, but their score is lousy, or the other way around, their score is great because they pay everything, but they're doing it by leveraging their credit cards?
Yeah, I think the scoring thing is very funny to me. The example I always give is like you and I might have the same exact credit score, 700, let's just say, or 720. So it's good, but it's not great. Except a couple months ago, you were 650 and you're on your way up. And a couple months ago, I was 820 and I'm on my way down. But a number's a number, and we both have the same credit score, and we're treated the same. And I think that's where we run into a little bit of the problem when we start to narrow things down to a single number, right? It's like, oh, well, look at that number. That tells us the story. Well, no, the story is I just lost my job and I'm struggling to make ends meet. And you just got a huge promotion and you've paid off a whole bunch of credit cards. We're two totally different people with the same number associated with us. So I think that's part of the history that you talked about and some of the problems that it leads to. I think tying back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, and I don't think, younger people are coming out of school, any kind of school, and really understanding like that whole spectrum of the credit score, where they land on it, and the things that they should be doing to climb up it, and why you'd want to climb up it. I think there's a lot there that can be unwrapped, obviously not in the time we have today, but there's something there that's definitely of concern.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. We could talk about this forever. We're going to have maybe a minute left, but I just want to ask before we close, is there some small thing that your company has done, that your team has done, that has made a big impact?
I think for our entire team, spending time face to face with our customers and hearing their stories revolutionized the way we approach our customers. But more importantly, when we gather all this research, is we make recommendations back to the business. And getting those stories as part of the bigger picture helped us build recommendations that really are supporting our customers in a way that we build relationships, we build trust, we give them confidence. I think previously, the idea was like, well, you're a transaction. How do we get you in, fill out an application, approve you for a loan, and get you out the door? And hopefully, you pay it all back. I think now we understand our people, our customers a little bit better. And that goes into every recommendation that we make. We're big customer advocates now. Where before, I think it was like, all right, how do we make sure that this company's maximizing our revenue?
Yeah, thank you so much. You gave great answers to questions that I wasn't sure would be that easy, but given your position and the data that you collect, I think you did a great job and I really appreciate it. And I think it's been
Pleasure.
eye-opening to hear. Yeah, I think it's been eye-opening to hear how somebody like Best Egg is, leaning into that human side of finance. And I think that's where you and I connected to begin with. And I just want to remind our listeners and our viewers or our followers that, I know you feel alone sometimes about this stuff, and you feel like the bank is the enemy, the financial coach is the enemy, whatever. You're not alone, and things are changing. Systems are starting to change. Maybe not fast enough, but they're changing. And so I would highly encourage you to reach out to a professional if you're struggling financially or not struggling financially and just want to manage your money better. And Michael, can I ask you to just give your website address one time for us? And I'll put it up on the screen for everyone as well.
Just go to bestegg.com.
Bestegg.com.
Easy,
Perfect.
easy enough, right?
Perfect.
All right, let's get your phone number, Francis.
Of course, it's 413-773-3333.
And you can always go to hugyourmoney.com. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Jess.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
Will you help us spread the word about financial fitness? Please like, subscribe, and choose all. Thank you. Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
The woman gets none of my social references. I talked in my Apple Watch. I said, I feel just like Dick Tracy. And she got a blank look on her face.
Yeah. Who's the Tracy?
Yeah. Has no idea what I'm talking about. So it's been an adjustment, but I'm lucky. She's a brilliant student. And
hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the money doctor, Frances Ram. What's going on?
We're going deeper than politics as usual. We have a returning guest, Senator Michael D. Brown, who spent 18 years as a U.S. shadow senator for Washington, D.C., fighting for representation. Can you believe this? And, of course, raising the roof whenever it was necessary. So he's been really outspoken on the barriers that young people face today, as well as a number of other issues. And I like him because he calls things like he sees them.
He makes good trouble.
Yeah, makes good trouble. Exactly. So he recently shook things up a little bit by teaming up with a 21-year-old woman co-host on his podcast, Shadow Politics. And I just had the pleasure of joining them. So today we're flipping the mic back around.
Cool.
And I have to say, this is completely unscripted, in case you can't tell, folks. That's how our shows always are. And we're going to talk about everything we can cram into one special edition, from food insecurity to federal dysfunction and personal triumphs to political theater. So let's dive in. So welcome back, Senator. Thank you for coming.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. You know, you're so much fun to talk to, for the same reason that you call them like you see them. And I appreciate
thank
that.
Thank you very, very much. You know, you've been in public service a long time. Wait, did I say that? Did that make you sound old?
A long time.
Okay. And you have seen power up close, right?
But I have.
You came from really humble beginnings. I think that's fair to say, right? I hope you don't mind me saying that.
No, I think what I had was an advantage as a kid. I mean, I started working when I was 14 years old, and I did come from a background where we were always broke, but I grew up in a white middle class kind of working class neighborhood. There were a lot of people around me that cared about me, and you know, I had a lot of support. And when I was a kid, I loved working. I loved having my own money and, you know, and trying to help my family out, which is what I did. And, you know, back in the days, I tell my kids all the time, all these things I did, but then I think back and I say, you know, gas was 28 cents a gallon when I pumped it, and you got a free glass if you got 8 gallons of gas. Now think about that. That's about $2 worth of gas. You got a free glass, and we washed your windows and put air in your tires and whatever else you needed. So, so I could live on $2 a week. But I think the thing that was beneficial for me is that it built in me a really strong work ethic, you know, and I always worked hard. And I think that came in handy. And I think that the one thing that distresses me most when you want to talk about young people right now is that I see a lot of them giving up hope. That's the thing that bothers me most.
Yeah. It is about choices, for sure. I mean, we do, you know, here, that's what we do, is help people figure out what their priorities are and fund those. But for instance, you have been living in Washington, D.C. Now you're moving to an island off the coast of Maryland with Mrs. Brown. And hosting this Shadow Politics podcast with a 21-year-old woman named Liberty. So there's a few changes here, you know, you know, that might sound a little bit like I'm spotlighting your successes, but as we know, you've had hard times. So when we talk about, you know, young people feeling this way, I brought this topic up when we were talking on your podcast with Liberty, that they're not the first generation to face tough times. They won't be the last, probably. So, okay, here's a question for you. If you could turn the clock back and ask a question of your 21-year-old self, what would the question be? And what would his answer be?
I would ask my 21-year-old self what was really important in life. And I think my 21-year-old self would probably give some lame answer to that question, like some material thing or some, you know, not understanding that there are much deeper, more important things in life than what you own and what you have. And let me just tell you that, you know, because I grew up in the 1960s, so I was, you know, we were all about consumerism. I mean, we all hugged each other and wore tie-dye t-shirts and sang Kumbaya. But the truth of the matter was that when 1970 rolled around, we all copped out, got jobs, bought houses, you know, did whatever. And I think that I was much more focused on getting ahead in those days and really didn't understand what getting ahead was. You know, it's not, it's really not so much getting what you want. It's more wanting what you've got. You find that out as you get older and what's really important, my children, relationships, friends, the associations you build, the experiences you have in life. And it's hard to see that at 21. I dropped out of high school, so going to college was a big deal for me. I got in to a community college because of equivalency diploma, and I got a degree, so the four-year college took that, and I got another degree, so I went on and got a master's degree, but that was very important. I was really consumed by it at that time because I worked as well as went to college. That's another thing. I always had an objective, and I would say that that's so important when you're young, is not to be rudderless. That's another thing that I think my 21-year-old self wouldn't have known, is that you really have to follow what your passion is, right? Whatever that is. And politics was my passion.
Yeah. What do you think he would have said back to you if you'd said any of those things?
Something really stupid, like, really, man, that's, I get it. You know, even though I didn't. Yeah. I had a brilliant sister who was a lawyer, and I used to drive her crazy with stuff like that. She said something to me, I go, really? I was kind of a punk. So I had a chip on my shoulder, you know. And it wasn't until, you know, I started getting in trouble and realized that, you know, badass wasn't really a profession that I was going to be good at, so that I should, you know, turn into a nice guy or, you know, it just wasn't me. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't the tough guy that I tried to be.
Well, you certainly directed your badass self into politics, right?
And I had help. I had a sister, you know, I had an older sister who saw everything for, you know, she would. I thought about going to law school one time, and she said, she looked at me and she said, "You can't go to law school. You'll never make it through law school. You won't make it through the first semester because you can't buy the textbook." So I'll never forget this. She said, "You can't buy the textbook 2 weeks before the semester's over." Okay. Yeah. So I didn't go to law school, and she was right. I went into graduate school, and she was, by the way, she was very proud of me when I got my master's degree in social science and political science. Somebody asked her what my degree was in, and my sister said, "I had just gotten a degree in the study of the obvious." She thought there were two types of people in the world, lawyers, which she was, and people that weren't smart enough to be lawyers and they became brain surgeons or something else.
Yeah, and she was wrong. And it turned out that you found your path.
Wrong.
Yeah, you found your path in something great. Speaking of finding a path in something great, Jay has been doing this North Quabbin Foodathon for 22 years. He and his brothers actually started it. And they feed through six pantries. They raise enough money through six food pantries locally to feed a district to help feed a district, right? And so it's gotten bigger and bigger every year, and he can tell you a little bit about that. But this was my first experience with it. Jay asked me to come in and help interview a few people, and I was happy to do that. But it was 12 hours of people feeding their neighbors, right? They don't know who they're feeding, but they're digging deep and they're coming out with money to feed their neighbors. I tried not to get political about this, but we did have two politicians that were interviewees while I was there. And they both gave great answers to things. But I just couldn't help but think, you know, meanwhile, Washington's tangled up in these headlines from, you know, Trump's trial to the big, beautiful bill that, you know, dare I say, might throw a boatload of
which
people
passed
into
the House by one vote.
Big, beautiful
one
bankruptcy.
Vote. Boy. We will be back with part two of Financial Fitness. This is so interesting with the money doctor, Francis Ram. I'm sure people have questions. Can we get your phone number?
Of course. They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
Or as always, go to hugyourmoney.com.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
How are we going to bridge that gap between something like the grassroots action that the foodathon that Jay is involved in, and I would love it if he can give a better description than I've given, okay, and national distraction? So, Jay, I'll ask you first to give us a little background on it.
Yeah, well, the foodathon itself, we just started in 2004 to just try to do something every year that would make a difference. And everybody was saying it would be nice, Senator, if we didn't have to do this again. Well, of course, as you know, I'm sure, that's not going to happen. So it's been going on since 2004. And thankfully, we get a guest every year in the name of Jim McGovern. And he, you know, always comes on and proclaims, and I believe him, that this problem is fixable. We can fix it. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, told us how the House Rules Committee meeting, their hearing, was going to start at 1 o'clock in the morning anyway.
Yeah.
So it's so ironic that we had him on, Senator, at 8:30 in the morning, and then he was back on doing his duty at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, holding the hearing. I mean, we wanted to do what we could do, and we asked people this year to, you know, to kick in a little bit more if they could, because this effort brings in money locally and gives it right back out locally to these six pantries. There's no rigmarole in between, it goes directly to them. And, you know, thank the Lord and the community that comes forward. As of this moment, it's $42,000 we raised in 12 hours. But it'll probably last 3 months in these pantries. And now with these, depending upon what the Senate does with this bill, the big, beautiful bill, you know, I don't know.
Well, you got a better chance in the Senate of having something happen. You know, the House is just, there's an old saying in politics that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And the House has certainly shown that. They're just going to line up behind this guy no matter what he wants to do, no matter how absurd it is. How long do you think we could supply those pantries, Jay, if we turned in the $400 million jumbo jet that the president just received as a parting gift from his Arab friends? First, let me say thank you for what you're doing. That's great. I know personally what a great feeling it is to feed hungry people, because for 12 years, I took my children to a soup kitchen once a month during the school year. And I can't tell you, anybody that's out there that's listening, do this. It's especially if you have kids. My kids fed homeless women and realized that the one thing you could say about homeless women that you can't say about everybody else is that they're homeless. There's nice ones, there's mean ones, there's happy ones, there's sad ones. They're just like everybody else. They just need to be fed and they need to be taken care of. And it demystifies it for them. My kids have all grown up to be adults that really care about the people around them. And I really give a lot of credit for that, to the fact that there was a program that they could get into where kids fed these women at a shelter here in town.
That kind of story that I was just telling about, you know, everybody had one common goal. It was just to feed their neighbors. What do you think it would take to bring that kind of nonpartisan collaboration to Washington? And is it even possible anymore?
Well, unfortunately, history tells us that to make that happen in America, you need some kind of political crisis or disaster, right? Mm-hmm. You never had a greater spirit of patriotism and cooperation in America than you did during the Second World War. I mean, not for all groups of people, but in general. And we saw New Yorkers who are notoriously right. They have a reputation for being somewhat short-tempered and you know, grumpy. We saw them all come together after 9/11. Didn't matter who they were. You know, we tend to pull together when there's some need. You know, like you saw at feeding people. You know, that's the thing that brings us together. And then once we touch each other, we realize our common humanity, right? Which we all have things in common. I don't care if you voted for Donald Trump. I'm willing to bet you love your children, just That's like right. I love my children. You know, yep. I don't care if you voted for Donald Trump. I would be willing to guess that you're glad you live in the United States. You're glad to be an American. You're glad, you know, just like I am. You know, there are a lot of things that we have in common. There's more, we have more in common than separates us. And that's why, for example, on my podcast, my first co-host, my long-term co-host, was a Republican woman from the West Coast. The idea was that we would show that this liberal guy, this liberal Democrat from the East Coast, and this conservative Republican woman from the West Coast, even though we weren't alike, we had a lot in common. And that's why I continue on the show with Liberty. I mean, I told you this when we talked, when you were on the show. It hurts for me to even say it, but Liberty is exactly 50 years younger than I am. So it's like she looks at exactly the same things I look at and see something totally different. Mm-hmm. And that's really an important thing, is right. We have to try to see from each other. We have to see, try to walk a mile in the other person's shoes, to quote to use an old quip. But I would tell you, if I had to leave five pieces of advice to my children, one of them would be what Einstein said, that what you see depends on where you stand juxtaposed to what you're looking at. So I think to bring us together, we all need to try to stand in the other person's position. And, you know, I've been in many of those positions. Again, I think I was benefited by the fact that I was close, that I could see poverty, that I could, I know people that were impoverished, but I myself was never impoverished. I was broke a lot of the times, but I always had everything I needed to get by. So it's easier for me, I think, to empathize with other people because I've come a long distance in my life and I've worn a lot of different hats. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to understand where people are coming from. You know, it's, crazy, you know, but it's been an adjustment dealing with this young, the woman gets none of my social references, you know, and it's like I have an Apple Watch and I was taught, we were at an event and I looked at my, cause she worked for me for a while. And I looked at my Apple Watch and I said, I talked in my Apple Watch. I said, I feel just like Dick Tracy. And she got a blank look on her face.
Yeah, who's Dick Tracy?
And, yeah, has no idea what I'm talking about. So it's been an adjustment, but I'm lucky. She's a brilliant student, and it's been an interesting mix. But that's what we have to do. We have to understand where these people are coming from. Like, look, a good example for me was this football player, Kaepernick, who refused to stand during the national anthem. Okay. Mm-hmm. lots of people in Washington supported his First Amendment right to express himself. Mm-hmm. And I certainly understood that. But I come from a veteran family, and I also understand why people were offended by it.
Sure.
You know, and that's what we have to do. You know, we have to try to understand where people are coming from. And we don't. There's a guy named Jürgen Habermas, a German philosopher, that says there's always a gap between theory and practice. And, you know, the theory of democracy is really, really beautiful. But the practice of it is, you know, what we say in Washington, is you shouldn't watch people make policy or make sausage, you know, because the process is pretty much the same. And what starts out maybe as a very noble idea very often gets turned into something else because of the self-serving nature of our political system. You know, these people are all worried about surviving. I love people that talk about term limits. You know, they want to put term limits on people. Every congressman has a 2-year term limit. If you don't like him, don't send him back. And you may think that he's in there forever, but he never thinks that. He always worries about what's going to happen in 2 years. He always worries about the pressure. One of the first things that my colleague, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is in the House of Representatives, told me when we had our first meeting was, nothing is ever generated from inside the walls of Congress. Everything comes from outside. All the pressure comes from outside. The ideas come from outside. The policy starts from outside. And so that's the one place where we can have an effect. But unfortunately, we don't pay a whole lot of attention to politics, you know? And we have a complex system that requires intelligent input. Basically, Trump has gotten away with this because he tells us what we want to hear. There are a lot of people that are out there that want to hear, it's not your fault. The economy's doing bad, but it's not your fault. It's the fault of all these people sneaking over the border and stealing your jobs, which we all know isn't true, right? But the guy that goes to McDonald's to order something and can't understand the person on the other end of the, you know, the little mic that he orders through, because she's got a heavy accent, he said to himself, there you go. You're stealing our jobs, you know. Now, I don't know when we started worrying about the Canadians sneaking over the border and stealing our jobs, or the New Zealanders, you know. This has gotten crazy and out of hand. And what I think this guy is trying to do is just create chaos. And if he does that, he assumes that he can rebuild the government in his own image. You know, we're all getting ready for the big parade here in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
$40 million to say happy birthday, Don.
Self, yeah.
You know, I have to ask you, I mean, having had that experience at the Foodathon, I watched people from all political backgrounds working side by side with one goal in mind. How do we feed people? Nobody asked who you voted for or anything like that. I didn't hear anything that was sharply political anywhere. You almost can't avoid some stuff these days. But it was all just, how can I help? So why does that kind of unity vanish when we get to Capitol Hill?
Because, you know, everybody's following their own self-interest, and this is a problem. I mean, I would say the same thing to you with kids. If you have kids, you know that you can take 5-7-year-old kids, different sexes, from different backgrounds, from different countries, and you could put them in a room and they'll bond in 5 minutes. I don't, you know, right? And older, they'll be running around playing with each other, loving each other, hugging each other. But adults can't do that, right? Because of all the stuff that gets in the way. The kids are single-minded. They want to play. That's what they want to do. You know, we want all sorts of different things. So you get up there to Capitol Hill and everybody's following their own self-interest, and really the general welfare gets lost often in the process. And Karl Marx said this about capitalism. He says capitalism and democracy can't work because everybody felt following their own self-interest will never promote the general interest. In America, we've been able to change that dynamic by little things like putting a constitution in place and giving minority rights and giving, you know, and things like that. And all the stuff they're trying to get rid of right now, DEI, you know, all the other intervening things that we put to try to straighten out that process where it turns out to be a survival of the fittest in a capitalist democracy. I think we're at a real turning point now. Can we translate this feeling? I think you could have the experience that you had, Doc. I think you could have in a lot of different contexts. You could have had it at a little league game. You could have had it at some kind of event where people were coming in, a disaster relief event. When you get down to one-on-one with people, it works a whole lot better. And that's really the trick, is trying to translate that into national policy, into competing ideas and motivations.
What was that delineation between Republicans and Democrats again? Democrats want to get along?
Democrats
fall in love.
Okay. Yeah, and Republicans fall in line. And that's and that's so true, you know. I mean, look, I've been a superdelegate for many, many conventions for nominating. I've been to 13 nomination conventions for the nomination for president. I went to one where Hillary Clinton was the nominee. She had won the nomination before she went to the convention. She had the a requisite number of delegates to win. And for the first 2 days of the convention, people chanted Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders, Bernie, 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 until Sarah Silverman actually came on stage and told them to shut up. Said, shut up, it's over. But you never see that in the Republican Party. You would never see that. I mean, you know, we shoot ourselves in the foot a lot as Democrats. You know, that's another great quote from Will Rogers. Will Rogers, and this is the most real thing I've ever found about politics. There's never been truer words spoken. He said, I belong to no organized political movement. I'm a Democrat.
This is really enjoyable talking to Senator Michael Brown. I'm sure people have questions. Can we get your phone number?
Of course. They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
Or as always, go to hugyourmoney.com.
Will you help us spread the word about financial fitness? Please like, subscribe, and choose all. Thank you.